Ladies and gentlemen, we're ready for oral argument in the case of the National Labor Relations Board against HH3 Trucking. Mr. Kent.
May it please the Court. My name is Ethan Kent, and I represent the Hudsons in this matter. The Hudson's position here is that substantially all of their income is exempt under, among other things, ERISA's anti-alienation provision. Of course, the NLRB's position is that once benefits are paid, ERISA's anti-alienation provision no longer applies. I'd like to make four points. First, that the Supreme Court case of Guidry 1 controls in this case. Guidry 1 was a case in which the Supreme Court held that a district court could not impose a constructive trust on a pension fund. And although this case differs in its facts in that we're discussing paid benefits, same considerations.
Isn't that relatively important? What ERISA says is that to be tax qualified, a pension fund has to have particular attributes.
And
that, as I understand it, is the main basis for what the briefs call the majority rule among the courts of appeals, that this is a rule applicable to the administration of pension funds. They can't honor attachments, rather than a rule applicable to the rest of the world after benefits are paid. And why isn't that straightforward?
Well, Your Honor, the plain language of the statute refers to what a pension plan shall do, as the NLRB mm-hmm. also discusses in its brief. However, in Guidry 1, the court limited the action that a district court could take in seeking a remedy against a debtor. And so the Supreme Court was motivated by the enforcing the goals of the statute and in a sense applied the rule more broadly than it might suggest itself on its face. As you say, the statute is addressed to what a pension plan shall...
You lose me there. I don't know how the Supreme Court's Guidry decision could be said to have applied the statute more broadly than its language. The order at issue in that case was addressed to the fund. It told the fund that it had to do something. It had to honor an assignment.
Yes, Your Honor. District court applied a... The district court came up with a remedy of the constructive trust, and that remedy was not able to be enforced. It involved the pension plan not paying the money to the creditor, to the union, but the decision in Guidry 1 did inhibit what it was possible for the district court to issue as far as a remedy was concerned. And it did so in order to serve the statutory purpose of protecting the stream of income for retirees and making sure that those benefits could be used for retirement purposes.
Mr. Kent, denials of certiorari are usually said not to be very meaningful, but I wonder if there isn't an exception in this case. Because if Guidry 1 by the Supreme Court was as broad as you say, shouldn't the Supreme Court have been rather indignant about the Tenth Circuit's refusal to follow through and in what has been called, I think, Guidry 2 and 3, a different remedy was permitted?
Well, Your Honor, you're correct that it's usually said not to be precedential, and I actually have some citations for that. But I think another possible explanation for why the Supreme Court didn't address it again is that essentially any case that's situated like this case or like the handful of circuit court cases that are at issue here, any of those, that's a narrower category than what the Guidry 1 court resolved. In other words, before somebody can go after a pension fund that's paying out, they have to not be able to go after the principal. So it may just be that the Supreme Court had settled the most pressing issue and moved on with the number of petitions for certiorari. Perhaps the court didn't engage any further with that issue. But we'd also stand on the first point that you raised, which is that mm-hmm. The denials of cert have been held by the Supreme Court to be non-precedential.
So I guess I usually operate on the assumption that when they send a case back to a court of appeals like us with instructions to consider something and we do the same thing all over again that they just reversed, that that might get some extra scrutiny. If I could, let me ask you about the Fourth Circuit's position in Smith, which is the position, the decision that helps you most. In that case, the majority drew a distinction between benefits that had been paid before retirement as a lump sum and benefits that were paid after retirement as an annuity, finding the one accessible, the other not. And I guess my question is the First Circuit's question, which is why does that distinction make any sense, and is there a legal basis for it?
Well, Your Honor, as I recall, the Fourth Circuit explained it as pension beneficiary essentially by taking an early lump sum payment, opting out of the protections that ERISA's anti-alienation provision would provide if the fund were to go back into, they're opting out of the protections that would apply if it were held in the pension until retirement and then paid out.
Mm-hmm.
So some kind of concept of waiver or opting out of that protection. And I believe that's the way they distinguish the Tenneco case.
The question, in essence, is there any statutory or regulatory basis for drawing that distinction based upon the language of Section 1056D?
Based directly on the language of 1056D, no, I don't think that there's a mm-hmm. clear statutory basis for that distinction.
If Mr. Kent, if we were to disagree with you on this question about alienability, is there any reason why we should not, in light of recent developments, increase the required monthly payments back to $600?
Well, Your Honor, if we don't prevail on the ERISA argument, we still believe that we have Illinois state law operating as incorporated through the Federal Debt Collection Procedures Act, and if we lose the ERISA argument, operating directly, because as the Tenth Circuit held in the en banc Guidry III disposition, once funds pass out of the sphere of federal protection, which the court necessarily would have held is ends when the funds get paid out, we no longer have the issue of preemption that was worrisome. And actually, in the Tenth Circuit's Guidry III decision, they held that a Colorado state law against garnishment was not preempted by ERISA. So we would then fall back on the Illinois state statute, the 735 ILCS.
Yeah, I don't quite understand that argument, because the ERISA preemption statute is written in terms of state laws relating to an employee benefit plan. And to the extent that ERISA certainly the ERISA alienation claim or alienation provision, both what it does protect and what it does not, would seem to be relevant. And the Illinois statute, section 12-1006, under these circumstances, would seem to be applied to an employee benefit plan.
Well, Your Honor, if the funds are no longer, if the court held that
the Illinois law
right.
says because these are funds from an employee benefit plan, they cannot be part of an order to pay a debt. I'm paraphrasing loosely there, but the question really is, does that fall within the terms of the ERISA 1144?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the Guidry III opinion reached that conclusion, and in any event, that's for us something of a fallback argument, because it's our view that the Federal Debt Collection Procedures Act, in a sense, deputizes the state law and raises it above the level where it could be preempted.
Does the Federal Debt Collection Practices Act apply to contempt in light of the specific exemption for contempt proceedings?
Your Honor, the Federal Debt Collection Procedures Act the standards that underlie the contempt that is at issue are relevant to the enforcement of contempt. In other words, the standards that apply to a person seeking to enforce a judgment, availability of the contempt remedy is not entirely divorced from the underlying provisions that cover that. We cite a divorce case in our brief in which an alimony case in our brief in which the court held that in order to purge himself of contempt, husband had to follow the alimony laws that applied in the state, and so the standards for purging contempt are not free floating, and therefore the FDCPA is relevant to answering that question.
Which case is that? Mm-hmm.
It is I believe it is Ridgeway.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Kent. Ms. Roberts.
May it please the court, my name is Jessica Rutter, and I'm here today representing the National Labor Relations Board. The NLRB respectfully asks the court to hold that Mrs. Hudson's pension is available to pay the judgment in this case because ERISA's anti-alienation provision only applies to funds held by an ERISA plan and not to funds post-disbursement. The NLRB additionally asks the court to order the Hudsons to pay $600 per month to purge their contempt.
Is the NLRB asking that the ERISA benefits be attached or garnished, or is it just seeking an in personam judgment against the Hudsons?
The NLRB at this point is urging that the court finds that Judge Kim ordered, that the Hudsons...
Well, he didn't order anything.
Oh, sorry,
he made
I'm sorry.
A recommendation to us.
Right. As Judge Kim recommended that the pension be considered available in the sense
right.
of
but
the
I'm
Hudson's
not,
ability to pay.
I know exactly what he recommended. I'm asking what the position of the NLRB is. Does the NLRB want an order of garnishment or something equivalent against the benefits, or does it want an in personam judgment against the Hudsons as part of the remedy for their contempt of court?
The latter, Your Honor. So we do not want a garnishment. So the interpretation of ERISA urged by the NLRB is supported by the plain language of the anti-alienation provision, by the applicable Treasury regulations, by a comparison with federal public benefit statutes, and by the decisions of multiple other courts of appeals. This case is about two individuals who have already been found in contempt by this court, who have attempted to evade responsibility for violating federal law for almost 10 years, and who now raise yet another excuse. As the special master, Judge Kim, recommends, neither ERISA nor any other statute provide any excuse for compliance, and the Hudsons have failed to show an inability to pay. Additionally, the Hudsons' increased monthly income since the special master's report supports an increased monthly contribution towards the judgment. ERISA's anti-alienation provision states that each pension plan shall provide that benefits provided under the plan may not be assigned or alienated. Based on the plain language and grammatical structure of this text, it is evident that the anti-alienation provision applies to what the plan must provide, that it sets out the legal obligation of the plan fiduciaries. A pension plan, however, is unable to provide that benefits not be assigned or alienated once they are no longer under the plan's control.
Ms. Rutter, could I ask you to deal with two statutes that have been compared here? So first is the Social Security Act, and I know you can distinguish that in terms of statutory text, but I wonder if you can articulate any particular policy reason why we ought to treat retirement income under Social Security any differently than we treat retirement income under a private pension plan. My second question has to do with the Civil Service Retirement Act, which seems a lot closer to this in terms of the statutory structure and language.
Absolutely. So, Your Honor, in terms of the policy issues, certainly ERISA has a policy goal of ensuring income to pensioners. But ERISA is also a different statute, and different in type, in text, but also in what it does. So the four statutes that have been compared here, the Veteran Benefits Act, the Social Security Act, the Railroad Retirement Act, and the Civil Service Retirement Act, these are all federally public benefit statutes administered by the federal government. ERISA, on the other hand, is different. It is actually regulating private pensions. So it functions in a bit of a different way and more sets out what pension plans can and cannot do in an effort to reach that same goal. And so that also, I think, is important just to look at in terms of the structure of those statutes, what the functions that they perform. Though there is a shared policy goal of all of these statutes, there is also a difference. In terms of the Civil Service Retirement Act, the Tenth Circuit actually referred to the language in the Civil Service Retirement Act as broad language, and said that the text offered no hint that its protections were narrower than the Social Security Act provision. But the Civil Service Retirement Act uses the phrase, money mentioned by this subchapter is not assignable either in law or equity. And in contrast, ERISA directs pension plans to provide that benefits not be assigned or alienated. So I think that that actually is a very significant textual difference. And in addition, we also have Treasury regulations here supporting a narrower view of the scope, which doesn't exist in thinking about the Civil Service Retirement Fund. And the Hudsons argue in their reply brief that because the regulations have what they call a clawback provision, that the regulation contemplates reaching pension benefits once paid. But if one looks closely at the regulation, it clearly sets out arrangements in which the pension plan itself would honor an assignment or withhold payment for various reasons, including overpayment. Therefore, the regulation does not, in fact, contemplate any kind of exception for benefit once disbursed. And this is because Treasury properly interpreted the statute as not reaching benefits once dispersed. I also want to address the issue about the Supreme Court's decision in Guidry. So the Hudsons argue that Guidry 1 applies here, but they do so in contradiction of the text of the Guidry case, the Tenth Circuit, which decided otherwise on remand, and the other courts of appeals who have found otherwise. The Hudsons attempt to do, in essence, what the Supreme Court in Guidry warned against, that is, use this equitable argument around a policy goal to create an exception in contradiction to the plain text of the statute. And the Hudsons also argue that the board's plain language argument is not consistent with the Guidry decision because the court prevented a district court from ordering this constructive trust, which the Hudsons argue is distinct from what a pension plan can and cannot do. But as Your Honor pointed out, What the Supreme Court was saying was that the district court could not order a pension plan to do what Congress clearly set out it could not do. And this is completely different than what's at issue here, which is whether the court can order the Hudsons to pay what they owe with knowledge that it will be paid for with funds that originate from an ERISA plan. I also want to note an issue about the policy goal of ERISA to guarantee a stream of income to pensioners. In this case, the Hudsons will be guaranteed a stream of income to pay their expenses. Judge Kim was extremely attentive to that and did a thorough analysis of the Hudsons' expenses and income to ensure that they would have sufficient funds to pay their living expenses. And there are a range of other federal and state protections that exist to protect debtors from being deprived of funds to pay basic living expenses. Finally, I want to address the Hudson's argument that if ERISA does not apply, that it cannot preempt Illinois state law protection as allowed under the Federal Debt Collection Procedures Act. First, it is important to note that this action is not under the FDCPA. Rather, it is a determination of ability to pay in contempt. And while that means that the Hudsons do not have the protections provided by the FDCPA, they do have the protections provided in contempt, the opportunity to show inability to pay, which the Hudsons have successfully utilized here to ensure that they have sufficient funds to pay their living expenses. But even if the FDCPA does apply, the NLRB is in agreement with Judge Kim that, as the Seventh Circuit has already held, ERISA preempts the Illinois state statute at issue. ERISA preempts state statutes that relate to any employee benefit plan covered by the Act. While the Hudsons point to Guidry on rehearing en banc, in which the Tenth Circuit decided that while ERISA does not apply, that the funds were protected by a state statute, this case deals with a different statute, an Illinois statute, an entirely different statute than the one at issue in Guidry, which is a Colorado state statute. Guidry dealt with a Colorado state statute that exempted 75% of disposable earnings and included compensation received from pension or retirement benefits. It did not deal with plans. In contrast, the Illinois statute regulates plans, specifically as titled Exemption for Retirement Plans, and goes on to define plans falling within its scope so as to encompass ERISA-covered plans. The Illinois state statute then sets out that it is the debtor's interest and right to receive under that plan that is being protected. As already decided by this court, it is therefore preempted. In sum, because ERISA's anti-alienation provision does not protect funds post-disbursement and the Hudsons have had an increase in income since the special master's report, the NLRB respectfully asks this court to order the Hudsons to pay $600 per month as originally ordered in order to purge their contempt. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Rutter. Mr. Kent, well, your time has expired, but we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I'd like to follow up on 3 points. First, there was a discussion of policy, and one of the points that the NLRB made is that the four statutes that they cite, the Veterans Benefit Act, Social Security Act, Civil Service Retirement Act, and Railroad Retirement Act, relate to federal plans paying out federal money, and therefore they are distinguishable. In fact, all four of those statutes aim to serve the same purpose that ERISA's anti-alienation provision does, and while it's true that the checks are cut by the federal government in those four statutes, they are not purely federal. The Social Security Act and the Railroad Retirement Act both concern monies paid in by the person during their working years, so it's something like a pension and something like a purely federal benefit that doesn't reflect any money paid in. But the larger point is that those statutes aim to protect the same interest, which is the ability of a retiree to survive on the retirement savings and income. Next, there was a discussion about the Civil Service Retirement Act and how it uses the phrase money mentioned, and that money mentioned is a more explicit phrase than in ERISA, where it says the plan shall provide. The Railroad Retirement Act says that no annuity or supplemental annuity shall be assignable. So it's closer in that way to ERISA's language. But the overall point is that we have four statutes that seek to guard retirement income for a retiree. And although we can discuss the particulars of the text and compare and contrast, the point is the text is quite different among all four of those statutes, but all four of them protect paid benefits. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.